Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
That's awesome. Awesome.
That's awesome.
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 Oh, dude, that's awesome.
That's really awesome.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
Oh, awesome.
That's awesome.
With Stephen Bradford. Stevie B!
Bradford A!
Oh my gosh, I've never...
What is...
Oh, jeez!
He spilled the whole coffee on his computer!
Yeah, it's not good.
No, you gotta keep rolling on that!
Yeah, it's not good.
What do you mean it's not good? It's amazing. Let's try that again now. Dude, that is amazing.
Dude, that was petrifying. I was petrified.
This next guest has you so...
Oh my gosh, dude.
In disarray that you spilled your whole coffee over
your
computer and you have an audition here.
So there is
the pages are soaking wet.
I know. I hope I can retrieve my notes. I'm going to have to transcribe. You know, there are some people that when you're in their presence, you feel their charisma. There's some people who when you're in their presence, you just smell them like you.
Thank you.
And there are other people where you feel charisma, intelligence,
and
that wild card factor.
Yeah, that's something I don't feel anywhere near you.
That's fair enough.
At all, ever?
You never know. I'm not
only.
When
it's like 2 a.m. and we've been out a long time.
Well, when that hand comes under the covers, that's unpredictable.
That's
right?
Really not acceptable either. By the way, that's hashtag me too, and you should never touch me again.
There you go. So we have someone here that we've known for a long time, both from our show and other shows, and someone that is always fun to be around.
And he was kind enough to come do the podcast.
Yeah, on a day off.
You know, it's hard to get a hold of this guy, believe it or not. I mean, it's like, even though we work together, it's very difficult. He's not a big texter.
Yeah.
You know, I had to
You have to write him a handwritten letter.
I had to put out the bat light.
Seal embossed on
it. I had
to
contact a few different people.
Right.
I had the email.
Yeah.
I had to do, but finally,
mm-hmm.
he did respond.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that we have the one and only Roger Howarth.
Hey,
Roger!
Hi, guys.
Sorry, I just yelled and I said I wouldn't yell at you.
No. I texted you back immediately.
No, you did.
I texted so quickly that I waited a second before pressing send because I didn't want to seem overly eager.
Dude, what do you need?
That's
I'll
so
do it.
Cute. You guys were like playing games a little bit, like
yeah,
a little hard to get.
I took a deep breath. I reread it. I'm pretty sure what you saw in that moment was the little dot, 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 that something was coming.
Something was happening.
I was trying to
track him down and finally got somebody to text him. So
yeah,
it's amazing.
It is. Well, people have been asking for you
forever, Roger. By the way,
can you put the doubters to rest? We've been talking about this for a long time. We didn't post.
Yeah.
We didn't put you off. We didn't.
No, not at all. I'm so happy to be here. I'm not sure what took you guys so long, but
try to find you, Roger. That's what took me so long, dude.
Yeah,
and he's out,
and so.
I'm just happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you, dude. It's amazing.
We're delighted. You play a you've played so many characters in your span, but you're Franco now, and
we're not really even going to talk about that.
Hashtag Franco forever.
Because I wanted to learn more about Roger.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, now he's out. Now he's really leaving. Now he's like,
I'm gonna disappoint you. You know,
you were not gonna disappoint anybody.
It's not that interesting.
It is that interesting when you're such a fantastic actor, and you are, and you're
with varied interests and a curious intellect. That's one of the things I respect about him. He's very curious.
This is why I've been avoiding this. You guys are just too kind.
No, it's true though. But Roger, you got to be honest. It's like people don't really, you know, what's great about this podcast is we get to see a little bit, you know, behind the curtain. A lot of people don't get to see that. And people, I don't think, realize really how funny you are. Because Todd Manning wasn't he was pretty witty and smart, but you're just so funny that
thank you, Steve.
I wish people. I always tell people when we're out on the road, I'm like, man, if they could just see our rehearsals,
That is true. I think we.
But you were one of those people you were one of those people that is, you know, people always marvel at Steve. Oh my God! In real life, you're interesting, and in real life, you have a personality. And in real life, you have energy, and you laugh. You know, there are some people like people notice sometimes in my real life I'm not as animated as I am on TV, and I would say
you're taller.
Yeah, I'm definitely taller. But I would say in real life you're less animated than you are on screen sometimes.
Oh, for sure.
Right. So it's interesting that, you know, I it all depends what the role calls for, right? But you know, people might think that you're a super gregarious, outlandish fellow in real life, when in actuality you're a little more, I'd say,
reserved.
Dull.
No, not dull.
Believe me, I spent a lot of time with my thoughts. They're not all that. It's pretty much the same one over and over.
Yeah. You want to share it with us? that singular thought?
No, we're going to keep that private.
So, but you're from the East Coast.
I am from the East Coast.
Right. Whereabouts in particular?
I grew up just outside of New York City. I went to Hastings High School. Hastings-on-Hudson is a small town. The border is Yonkers.
Hastings-on-Hudson, a three-part town name.
It is.
Are there hyphens in between Hastings hyphen on hyphen Hudson?
There are.
Wow. So that sounds like a pretty quaint, lovely place.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's become even more quaint and more lovely. I think it's become almost precious.
Yeah.
When I grew up there, there was a mixed community. There were lots of different incomes and lots of different kinds of people, and there were still there was like a copper you know, the industry on the river was still
right,
like open. The Chevy plant was still open in Tarrytown, and so it was very different than it is now. Now it's become art galleries and tennis clubs and and that element was beginning there. Some of my friends lost, you know, their parents went to jail for savings and loan kind of insider trading.
Cool.
The houses on top, and it was literally the wealth was on top of the hill, and my father taught high school English and my mom was a librarian, so we kind of lived somewhere in between,
in the middle.
Yeah
Super suburban. Class of 85 in my high school.
Go 85.
So there were like 85 people, seven of them named Jennifer.
Right.
it was cool. It was a really, really. I'm really fortunate. It was a really nice. I had a
so
really
were you there the whole time?
Comfortable upbringing.
Is that your from K through 18?
Yeah, yeah. I
high school.
Yeah.
And
wow.
In the
went to the Treehouse Elementary School with Ricky Lake. We fought over a large yellow tricycle because she had it and I wanted it.
Of course.
And not much has changed. You know, she still has everything I want.
And you have a bike. But you have a bike now.
Is that why you insist on riding a bicycle?
Yeah. I don't know. My bicycle's never let me down. It's a pretty dependable.
That's pretty deep.
It is, actually.
Things are way more reliable than people. My bicycle makes me happy every time.
Yeah.
That's
every
awesome.
Time.
Yeah. I mean.
So let me add, hold on. I got to ask this though, because Roger lives kind of close to the studio here, so he does ride his bike in.
Rode his bike even when he didn't. When he lived by the ocean, he rode his bike sometimes.
I did a couple times. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that would be a great idea. It turned out to be
not so much. Not,
yeah. It was
not, so, because I'll come in and I'll see your bike in different places.
Yeah.
So, what do you?
Well, that's simple. I just take the door that's the. So there are different doors to the studio, and all of them have signs on the inside that say, do not prop this door open.
Right.
Because it's against some kind of fire code or
and
some
yet,
kind of
90% of the time
active shooter
open.
Protocol.
Right.
Yeah. And so I would much prefer to use the door that I'm not supposed to because it's just easier.
Right.
But sometimes I have to go by security and say good morning. And,
yes.
And then you'll hear the clicking of the
gears. Yeah, I hear
the gears
it down the, right down the
yep.
hall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He
yeah.
puts the baseball card in the spokes. It's
yeah,
yeah, it's pretty hot.
Dude, makes me feel young.
So was the city really present in your life? Were you going in to see shows? Like
when I was little?
Yeah.
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
I was there at least once or twice a week. My sister is 10 years older than me, or 9 years older than me. My brother's 10 years older than me. And my sister kind of ran away from home when she was 16 and joined a mime troupe. you know, as people
as
did.
As you do. I mean, gosh, what a rebel.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to go down there every weekend and see her, you know, trapped in a box or pulling a rope.
Fight, when she would fight with your parents as a 16-year-old, would she go into mime? Would she fight silently? Because that's an amazing – dude, that's an amazing story. That's an amazing, like –
She literally went out the window. I remember coming in to her room and saying, like, hey, what's like, – oh, wait a minute. Like,
in mime or literally out the window?
No, she had – like, in real. Yeah, yeah, no, it wasn't. She was gone. She wasn't there to mime. Right now, Bradford's doing
I tied all my sheets together and I climbed down my window.
That's good. That's good.
Spinelli has a new career.
Yeah. Wow. Good
so I would go down and watch, like, avant-garde dance troupes and mime troupes and all kinds of stuff. And my dad was kind of kicking around the Lower East Side at La Mama and Terry Shriver, and like he was a playwright and a director and an actor, and I'd go see, you know, crazy Ionesco plays that I didn't understand when I was like 7, and it was weird.
Yeah,
I was a weird kid, and then I asked. I my brother was a pretty accomplished musician. He went to the Manhattan School of Music.
Yeah,
and he was also working at the Met, at the Opera House. I'm not sure. He had a couple of different things that he would do there, and I would go down and I think my parents felt that they had provided that for my brother, and they thought, like, well, we'll give Roger an opportunity to go to music school. And so I had to go to music school.
Don't sound too excited.
Terrible. No, was it was just awful. I had zero. I studied piano because my grandmother was a pianist, and she played all over the world in this kind of group of, you know, before the internet, they'd write letters to people in it that had their names listed in a book of a chamber music forehand. Like, she was big on two pianos. That was really her favorite. But she would play, if somebody played the violin or the viola or whatever, she would find them and write them a letter, and then she would get on a boat and go to Chile and stay down there for 2 weeks and play music and get drunk.
Wow.
Yeah, she was cool.
Was she better at the piano when she was drunk?
She's better at the piano than no, she never – she drank every night.
Right.
But she never played piano after a drink. Wow. She just refused.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, compartmentalizing the –
right,
the art.
And then she'd – yeah.
So
I played the piano and the music theory and ear theory and all this stuff, and I was terrible at it, and it was just awful. And I said, look, I'm not into this, but, you know, I'd really like to, like, I think, like, you know, the E Street Band was making music, and Foreigner 4 had Jukebox Hero on it in the early, and there was a period of time in like the early 80s, late 70s, where every rock band had a saxophone solo, and I was like, I think I can do that.
You played the saxophone?
And this is dark, so I asked my parents, I was like, look, man, the piano thing clearly isn't working out, you're just yelling at me every day to practice, and then I'm not.
Right.
And it's just like this weird shame cycle that will, I'm sure, you know, continue into my 50s and of procrastination. So I asked, and then my dad, who was a high school English teacher, came home one summer. He had gone to the music department and grabbed what he thought was a saxophone, but it turned out to be an oboe. And so...
How do you make that mistake?
Dude, it was rough. I had to play the oboe at the Manhattan School of Music. I wound up to... No, I think it was completely deliberate. There was no accident.
I was
going to
say,
there.
Have you ever seen a black saxophone?
So there I was wearing my brother's, you know, hand-me-downs, which, you know, to wear clothes from the 70s and the 80s inspires the other kids to kind of give you a hard time. And my mom would put a bowl over my head and cut my hair, and then I played the oboe.
Oh, no.
So
wow, you had all the,
awesome.
The cards.
That's why I don't talk to people.
But that is character building.
You think.
That's a good you would think it would be.
So when did you decide that acting was – or because you didn't do any acting when you were a kid, or you did?
No, I for sure was always, you know, I was always in a play in the school.
Like, right.
We always, you know, we would do a really phenomenal production of The Hobbit or.
Yeah.
And then there was that. And then my dad would direct over the summer. He was a director for at least
one or two shows every summer at the College Light Opera Company in Cape Cod. So, like, all these kids that were legit musicians from Carnegie Mellon and all of these kind of big theater schools would spend their summers doing Gilbert and Sullivan and Lerner and Lowe and, like, all this. And that was, you know, that was my – that's all I did. Like, it was just sit and watch rehearsals. And then I wound up, you know, I think I did a – like, I played a messenger in the Grand Duke when I was, like, 8.
Okay.
Again, with the bowl haircut.
Yeah.
And
well, then it was appropriate.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, really fit.
Literally a page boy.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was my childhood. Was
so,
in
but
the theaters.
When you were sitting there as a young teenager watching these
Godspell, and
watching
Joseph
these college
and,
kids. Do
oh, for
theater,
sure.
You were like, that was enticing. Or
it definitely had its moments.
Yeah. So
you'd
spend the whole summer on the Cape with your dad, or at least
staring at college girls. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's
my job.
You're right. Exactly.
So it's my job.
But that's not a bad way to spend a summer as a kid.
I cannot complain about my childhood. I was really fortunate.
Yeah. So was there a time when you said, hey, I think I want to do this?
No.
So there was not a time where you said, I think I want to be a professional actor.
No, I still haven't decided. Like,
well, it's
decided
for you.
I just don't have any other skills, yeah. But I don't.
The universe has decided for you, sir.
I think there was a, and to be honest, like in my late 30s, early 40s, I had some kind of resentment, weird life kind of shifting energy where I just kind of realized like, oh, I never decided to do this. Like,
well, then who,
this is not what I want to do. I want to. And then I couldn't really fill in that blank.
Like, did someone
what I would rather do? There isn't anything else.
But you had to get an agent to go out on auditions and all that stuff. I mean,
yeah, but it all kind of like I stumbled through it. You know, I just kind of stumbled.
There was not an intentional, conscious intent to do it. Was there someone that you blame for getting you into it? You're like, I mean, because it sounds like that kind of resentment you had for your career would be really easy to blame somebody. Is there anybody you blame?
Yeah, but I mean, totally. I was the archetypal angry young man for no reason. I had no reason to be
into your 40s. That's really charming.
Yeah, I know. I'm developmentally. You can't say those words, but that's actually the appropriate
hence the bike
word. Yeah, exactly. That's now why
some
I'm
people get
around.
A Mazda Miata, you get a 10-speed.
I did freak out in my early 40s and decide I was going to ride my bicycle. That was my I got on a bicycle and I rode for 21 days
your own Forrest Gump moment.
Completely.
Yeah. Where'd you ride to? Everywhere?
I wanted to do a cross country. I wanted to go from Florida to San Diego. Yeah,
wow.
There's something that the bike geeks call the Southern Tier. I was intimidated by the Northern Tier because I didn't think I could get through the Rockies.
Yeah. That seems reasonable.
I could
barely get through with a car.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's not something. I mean, I'm glad I did it. It's not something I'm ever going to do again.
Did you do it?
No, I never made it across. Like, so the concept was that I would do the whole, but I didn't know how long it would take, and I just did like the last third of it. I shipped my bicycle to Central Texas, and then went from Texas to
what kind of bike? A road bike or just a regular bike?
A specialized brand. Yeah. Just a road bike, but it had some things on it for the kind of longer. Like we didn't cut weight on any of it because I knew I'd have bags of mostly food, really.
Yeah.
Mostly you're just eating all the
time. So is this a spandex moment or no?
Yeah, here's
it
the
is.
Thing.
It
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah. I swore I'd
to.
Never do. I know, no, no. For sure, I swore I would never do the superhero outfit. And even when I was riding my bicycle regularly with some friends in New York City, there were some routine bike rides that would go across the river, and it was really cool. And we all just made a pact like no spandex. I actually got past in my superhero outfit somewhere in Arizona or New Mexico. A guy skipped by me, just killing it on his 3-speed. He was on like a Schwinn in like blue jeans, a white Oxford shirt, and a cowboy hat.
Amazing.
And I was like, here I am with my
racing gear. So did you have the shoes that lock in on that type
of
bike?
I was clipped in.
So you were clipped in. So you went from Texas to where?
To San Diego.
There's some stretches there that if you get tired or run out of food, you're kind of SOL. There's areas in New Mexico where there's or in Texas where there's nothing.
You might be the food.
Right, that's true.
I really like the desert, and I like those kind of expansive long stretches where there wasn't a whole lot around. And so I was looking specifically for that. It was neat.
Right.
It was really cool. Beautiful. It's a beautiful country.
That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, and it was funky. I was right along the Mexico border, and there was a lot to see. It was really, cool. Three weeks.
So how many hours a day would you ride?
It depended.
Would you camp or would you get a hotel?
I did both, but the one day I camped, I was like, "Yeah, I'm not doing that again."
Yeah,
I did it one or two times.
That's amazing.
That seems fair. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Like, I'm done. I'm in my spandex and the sand.
Yeah.
I got cactus.
I definitely fell in the sand a couple of times. Because
you're not riding on the interstate. You're riding on local roads?
I tried to, for sure.
You can't ride on the interstate. It's illegal, right?
Correct. There were a couple of times where it was unavoidable, and you're just like white knuckling it because it's not cool.
No, dude.
And it's weird. Like the stuff that was on the shoulder in that particular stretch was like,
the roadkill
toilets and large sheets of plywood that seemed designed to put a flat in a bicycle tire because it had screws coming up.
How many flats did you get?
Dozens.
Yeah. Dozens.
No, it just happens. They come in. They usually come in threes. I've heard people say, bike geeks say, come in threes.
So do you just carry extra tubes?
Yeah, and just got tons of tubes. And
wow, man.
Stuff.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy.
Interesting. But, so we've become a biking podcast. That's great.
Yeah. No, but it's
fascinating.
It is fascinating. To do that.
Yeah.
I would do something like that again, but I would do it with people. This was something that I did to kind of, I thought it would clear my head. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It's a lot. That's pretty extreme.
It is extreme. Yeah. But that's cool that you did that, though.
Yeah.
Like, no?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if somebody told me now that they were going to go do that now, I would understand that they needed to or they felt like they wanted to. And it's a real luxury in this life to be able to just not, you know, to have that have that time is real.
It feels more like a compulsion to do it versus like a cool thing to do. Like, because the way you frame it, you're like, if someone said that they felt like they needed that or had to do that versus someone being like, hey,
I'm
just really
at a
cool
time in
do-
my life where like, I mean, when I would run long. I mean, I there was a time in between 99 and 2001, I was running like a
crazy
lunatic.
Like you were running from something?
Well, I was just going to say, Roger, what are you running or riding away from? No, I'm kidding.
No, you're not. I don't know. It's a good question. But now if somebody says like, oh, I want to run a marathon, I'm like, all right, have fun. That's cool. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. No,
but I will definitely support you and cheer you on
and
if that's what you're into.
Yeah. No, there's no part of that I want. Not at all. Not at all.
You mean no exercise at all?
Right.
Apparently.
Not at all. My head is clear enough. Thank you very much.
Sure it is.
So obviously it wasn't something that you consciously chose to take on, but what were the patterns that ended up getting you did you go to college for something else? Did you go, what did you start to pursue that maybe then got derailed?
Or I did go to college, but I kind of went to I went to college for three semesters, and I went because the grandmother that I was talking about earlier, she kind of, you know, she was as the matriarch of the family, and she had a big voice. She was a straight shooter. She was she was not afraid to say what she thought. And she said, and she was the one who would have paid. She paid for my college.
Okay.
Which made me intensely uncomfortable. It was hard for me to be in school knowing that it was not something that my family could really afford to
do. I see.
But she said, you should go to college because you'll never make it as an actor.
Oh, because so you wanted to be an actor.
She talked like that.
Yeah.
Well, I don't remember. Yeah.
Sure.
But I think also just by default. I had applied to some other schools to do some other things and I didn't get in. And so that was just kind of like the
I guess
that
I
path
should,
just kind
yeah.
of presented itself.
Yeah,
and
I
so,
get it.
So
sure.
I did it.
Yeah.
And then I felt bad about, you know, spending money that wasn't.
Where'd you go to school?
George Washington University.
Oh, wow. Nice.
I went there for one semester and then I went to the National Theater Institute for the second semester of my freshman year and studied puppetry and a bunch of weird, cool.
Yeah.
stuff, and then I didn't know what to do after that. So then I went back to the George. I went to GW again, and did a whole year there, and the whole time that. And then I knew at that point I was trying to line up conservatories. I auditioned for Juilliard and ACT and a bunch of schools. Didn't get in.
Right.
And then I went to at the end of my sophomore year. I went to the Williamstown Theater Festival to work as an apprentice or in their non-equity company. At that point, it was in their non-equity company.
Yeah. And spent a summer up there.
I did. I spent four summers up there.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
It was cool.
Yeah.
It was really cool. It was.
And when you're in the apprentice program, do you do ensemble stuff?
No, I went in high school. I went as an apprentice, and I was just building sets. I went as a tech apprentice. I wasn't an acting apprentice, and I just loved being around. Mm-hmm. It was. I loved that.
Yeah.
And it was cool. Like the plays were great.
Yeah,
like
they do amazing people, work. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when I went back in the Nana company, yeah, you're in the main stage and you're also working on, you're in class.
Oh, okay, cool.
And then doing smaller parts on the main stage. And then they have two or three other theaters. There's an outdoor theater.
Yeah.
And a black box. And so I think, I mean, in the course of two summers, I probably did like 12 plays or something.
Wow. That's amazing, dude.
Yeah, it was cool.
What an experience.
I was there with, and I met a lot of the people that I know still that are still in showbiz. Those are relationships that I made.
Yeah.
You know, when I was like 17 years old.
I mean, those summers, it's, I mean, as a young human doing that kind of creative work with a company like you are, there's no better, more exhilarating experience for a young person, I think.
I agree. It was super fun.
Yeah.
It was super fun. Yeah. I loved it. I had my last name's Howarth, and the guy before me, his last name was Hoffman. So they paired, you know, like the first week we were there, they didn't have a place for anybody to stay, so they threw us in a college dorm together. And
oh,
so
yeah.
It was Philip Seymour Hoffman and Roger Howarth were roommates.
Oh, my god.
We had to figure out who was going to be the top bunk and who was going to be the bottom. That's not code for anything. We were literally trying to figure out, like, well, is that better? Or, like, what do you want? Or, and so we got to be friends, and we spent he and I moved to New York City together at the end of that summer and lived together. And he had just like two dudes trying to make a living being an actor.
Yeah, for sure.
And he's a really sweet guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Phenomenal actor.
That's my name dropping story. That's all I got.
That's all you got.
Dude, that's a good.
You got a Michael. You got a Michael Easton story somewhere.
So, you're at what age now? Living in the city, out of school of sorts.
Yeah, I was 19, maybe
19. And so, and then the work just came.
And you just got an agent.
Yeah, got an agent. I did, and it's remarkable. I'm not really sure how. I don't remember how that worked.
Well, you were living with Philip Seymour Hoffman. I guess maybe memories
she
are...
She passed on him. She was like...
Your agent did?
Yeah, I said to my agent, I said, look...
No, I was just saying the memories might be vague for a good reason.
We were both sober at the time.
Oh, okay, all right.
Me more so.
Varying degrees of sobriety, right. Yes,
yeah, Yeah, he struggled.
Yeah,
and then he got his shit together and then things started to go really well for him.
Yeah. But you were chosen. It was you. You were the one.
I'm trying to remember now how I managed to get an agent, because I do remember like there was a scene night at the end of the Williamstown Theater Festival, and I did some terrible
showcase or something.
Yeah, and I can't believe that anybody asked me to. When I'm looking back on that performance,
that
like, what?
Well, you had great hair, no doubt, and
thank you, Brad, for had that going for me.
Yeah. Thanks, Brad. why don't you start a self-esteem school? it'll close within 48 hours.
No, I think
oh, your
I remember
hair looks good though.
I remember the looks on people's faces because a woman named Allison and I decided we would do like. Some Elizabethan, it was in verse, and the subject matter was incest. and like a
that's
brother,
a winner.
A brother sister saying like, oh, I'm so tortured by feelings for you, but I can't possibly. You're my brother. You're my sister. Oh no. I can't believe at the end of that like 6 or 7 minutes that anybody was like, we'll take that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
That is funny.
Wow. So what was your first? What was your first paying job? Do you remember?
I got my equity card from the Public Theater. Joseph Papp was still alive, and I had done a couple of productions of the. I'm a little weird about this. I don't say the name of the Scottish play. It's like the
one thing
that I'm kind of, because I've done it twice, and I've seen people like totally get.
So
Richard Jordan was directing at the Public. And I auditioned, having done it a couple of other times, once at Stage West and then, I don't know, in Springfield, Massachusetts. And
wow. A lot of time in the Berkshires for you.
Yeah, I love the Berkshires. Yeah. So I read for a part in that with this lunatic director who was completely coked up and just a crazy person. And I didn't get the part, but they were like, look, you can carry a spear.
What?
No, hold on. Let me amend that. You can understudy the guy
who carries the spear.
So that was my first job. And the guy who got the part was some guy from some show called As the World Turns.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, well, I guess that's what I got to do to
get on a
to do a play with Raul Julia, which is what that guy got to do. Tom Gibson, who went on to do.
Oh, yeah.
I forget whatever that procedural was for.
Oh, Thomas. Yeah.
Been on a date with my sister.
Well, and also Dharma and Will.
Right.
Dharma and Greg.
Dharma, yeah.
I was thinking Will and Grace.
Will and
Dharma.
Grace, Dharma and Greg, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my – they gave me my equity card, and then I just started working from there. And then I was doing a play at the WPA Theater called The White Rose, which was – pretty awful. And Larry Brigman was in that. Larry Brigman was played Dr. John on a show called As the World Turns.
Oh.
And my wife was pregnant.
Yeah.
And I was making $180 a week.
In Manhattan, which is pretty good.
In Manhattan.
Yeah.
It was okay. It was okay. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. No, that hadn't happened yet. The city was still like...
Yeah, you could still survive.
Yeah. For sure. But the casting director named Vince Leapart came to see his friend Larry in The White Rose.
The White Rose.
There was I got a call from Vince Leapart, my agent got a phone call like the next day after he had seen the play. He said, we'd like to use Roger for a day on As the World Turns. And the pay, it was 10 weeks. It was like $1,800 for the day. And I was like, I can work for one day or I can work for 10 weeks.
In the theater.
And the role was Holden, who's played by John Hensley.
John Hensley, right.
Oh, it was a John recast Hensley, for a day?
Well, John was getting a little fussy in a contract negotiation. And it said, like, I'm not coming in tomorrow or something like that. I never spoke to him about this. I met him later, obviously.
Right.
But and I never said, hey, man, like, what were you doing? But here's the thing. I'm like a skinny 19-year-old. So my son's about to be born, so I'm 23. And they handed me this script that was, I know people say we do 70 pages a day here, but we usually don't. But this was a 70-page day.
Oh my gosh.
This was the day.
Wow.
And so I took the script and I went home and I learned all of these names and Lily and Holden and who's Dr. John and who all the people were. I had to learn all of the nouns, which we don't have to worry about now that we have regular gigs. But at the time, I was like, I don't know who anybody was. And, of course, it was also a scene in front of a fireplace with no clothes on a fur rug. I swear to God.
That's amazing.
And then I walk in this robe, and I'm really nervous. And some guy named Hutch. Who is this guy? Do you remember him? Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
He went on to do, like, a Chuck Norris series.
Lucky. Oh, Judson Mills?
Judson Mills was running up and down the
incredible,
the hallway with almost no clothes on, screaming at me and anybody else who would be. He was super high energy.
Yeah,
I'd never
was.
Been in the same room with another human being like this.
Yeah, Judson wow. was a – I hung out with Judson for
– He was super fun.
A little while.
I had no idea how to – like, I didn't know what
– He's a wild man.
Okay, so
– We were close to being – in jail.
Dead.
That does not surprise
and
me.
Dead.
So that was the energy, and then I they hand me this robe, and then I walk onto this huge sound stage. I've never been on a sound stage, and then there's a rug, and there's a fireplace, and there's a very angry looking redhead who's very upset that it's that I'm
and
there.
It's you and, not, yeah.
And I go, okay, and in my head I'm going, okay, you know, I'm trying to remember what all the words were, and then John just kind of saunters in and takes his clothes off, and it's like, never mind, I'll do it. And then he did the whole thing. So they gave me all of this money, and I in the end, I didn't have to do anything for it.
And so that's not on your IMDb either, right?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, you never aired as that character.
No,
right,
I never.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, right.
He's never been on the internet, dude.
Yeah, fair enough.
No,
I'm kidding, Roger.
I know what it is.
I know.
And so, yeah, that was that day. And then I said to my agent, that's a great, I love that. Can we do more of that?
More of that, please. Yes.
That would be great.
Please,
more
of
that free money. Well, it wasn't really free because you went through some anxiety for...
I did have a lot. I mean,
you
I don't
hang
think
out in the
ever...
bathrobe all day. That's pretty good.
Yeah, but that's anxiety. There's some anxiety there, dude.
Oh, I get, yeah.
It's an anxious
It's pressure.
Job.
It's pressure.
Yeah.
There's some pressure for
Sometimes.
Sure.
Sometimes.
There's some pressure.
So then, anyway, then I... Yeah, so she submitted me for a frat guy number or whatever on One Life to Live, and then I got that job, and I just kept it for... Going on 20
so
some odd years now.
That's how Todd started as like...
they were looking for... Oh, that's not true. Is that true? Am I screwing this up?
It's all right. We'll believe you.
No, I'm screwing it up. It was a long time ago. I got another job after that. That's what... So I said, yeah, I'd really like to do more of this. And so she submitted me for a role on Loving.
Oh, okay.
And I got an audition for Loving. And they were like, no... I'm going to, like, I had spent a fair amount of time, I told you, like, my idea of what acting was this kind of Shakespearean something or other, I don't know, somewhere on the said internet, there is footage of some of the performances on Loving.
You're really
terrible.
Pretty grand?
Oh, just horrible. And it's like the James Spader role from every... You know, kind of 80s movie where it's like he's the frat boy who's like, yeah, let's cut his brakes or something. And it was me and Michael Weatherly and a young Laura Wright.
Yep.
Amelia Heinle.
Yep.
And
George Palermo.
I don't know George Palermo.
You don't know George?
No.
Oh, he was on Loving for a while.
Okay.
Because he worked with Laura a lot. So I thought it might have just
no, it was
been
Paul,
right after
Paul
you.
Anthony Stewart.
Paul Anthony there. Stewart also, yeah.
And they all didn't get fired. I got fired right away. I got fired and I had just bought a piano. Like my grandmother, who the piano player was like, oh, You're making some money now. Let's go buy. Let me help you pick out a Steinway.
Let's get back into the piano, which you loved so much.
Yeah, exactly.
You cherished your piano skills.
So we went to Steinway and picked out a piano and then like, you know, didn't make it out of the first 13-week cycle and had to go back to Steinway on 57th Street.
Can you return a piano?
You can if you ask really, really, really nicely.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well,
my grandmother had some pull there because she bought, like, she was a teacher. And
she could pull some strings.
She did. She had, like, some kind of weird VIP Steinway status.
Yeah.
Sweet. That's amazing.
So they took it
back.
FabFitFun is a women's lifestyle subscription box filled with full-size, premium beauty, lifestyle, fitness, home, and tech products sent straight to your doorstep each season. They take the hassle out of shopping by doing it for you.
Everyone loves mail, especially boxes with stuff. Imagine a box filled with the best stuff out there, curated just for you. The best gift you could ever give yourself or somebody else.
And if you hate surprises, each box can be customizable as well. So it's truly your box. Now, these boxes retail for $49.99, but always have a value of at least $200, most often more than that. And if you use our coupon code, that's awesome, one word, you get $10 off your first box at FabFitFun.com. So that is $39.99 for a box of amazing products that's worth over $200.
The Summer's Editor's Box is available now and is the perfect way to treat yourself or others and keep cool with these carefully curated box of products. Summer equals relaxing, and FabFitFun wants to give you back your time by shopping for you. But don't wait, because these boxes always sell out.
And don't forget to check out the FabFitFun community, where you can find add-on sales, FabFitFun TV, and the FabFitFun community forum.
But start by getting your first incredible FabFitFun box for $39.99. That's 10 bucks off by using coupon code That's Awesome at checkout.
How long was Loving?
13 weeks.
Oh, that was the cycle. Yeah, 13 weeks.
And they fire you 5 weeks in, so yeah.
Awesome.
It didn't last long at all. And they were right. They were terrible. They cast the woman to play opposite the character that I played, they cast her first, and I think they were – I think it was literally just a case of, like, I went into audition, and it was me, and I was, strangely enough, the same height I am now, even though Franco's a little taller.
Yeah.
And I think I just got the part because I was a little taller than the other guy that auditioned.
Interesting, yeah. What did you learn there?
At Loving?
Yeah.
To save – Well, no, I never learned that then.
Save your money.
Nothing. I didn't learn anything.
Yes, you did.
What did I learn? I don't know.
Did you realize you were too big? Did you watch yourself and go, ooh? Or did you watch yourself going, I'm freaking awesome?
No, I've never, ever watched myself and said you're awesome.
Okay.
That's never come out of my mouth.
But so did was there feedback? Did you walk out of there at least having learned something, or were you just pissed? Or what was – do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, I think I adjusted the scale of things, and I kind of look at – I don't know how you guys see it because you've both been at it a long time. But, like, I think that it's just a slow-going process of just getting over yourself. Like, that's what being an actor for this long requires.
Yeah.
Like, but just letting go the things that – because, honestly, every time I walk up to the floor, if I say, like, oh, this thing's going to be cool, let's do it this way, it just always winds up – I always wind up feeling like that wasn't the right idea.
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't know how you guys feel about it. But
you know, it's interesting because there are times that I've worked with you where I've seen you work where I feel like – and this may just be your fondness for mischief, but – and I'm curious to hear if this is anywhere near the truth, but I feel like sometimes you're like, why don't I just drop an Alka-Seltzer in this one? Like, just...
Because I'm upset in my
stomach? No. This seems like the right time to just throw something in here. Because I don't think you come up to the stage going... I'm going to do something.
Yeah, no, what I'm saying to you is that when you walk up those steps with an idea of exactly what you want to do,
right.
I think that's the day that you leave the building thinking...
Disappointed.
We didn't get there.
Right.
You start to question whether or not it was the best decision.
Yeah.
So I think that you guys do the same thing. I think we make adjustments all the time.
Yeah.
And if we could rehearse more and do it more, it would always be different and we'd always be shifting it. And then, I mean, within the parameters that we've designed, like, you can't, you still got to do this blocking. You have, you know, you're responsible to the other people to say some form of the words in the script and et cetera. But
sure.
We're not improvising, but you have to continually be trying to find. And sometimes I think the last one winds up being the best one. And then sometimes I'll make a decision and try something new. And I'm like, oh, I wish we'd just use the other one. That would just,
wow, at least you get two takes.
But
that's,
you know,
cool.
No, I mean dress rehearsal. Yeah.
But you're really you're probably, I don't want to say more in the moment, but you're really comfortable and in the moment more than most, I would say.
Very kind of you. I think
I would say, you know, just by watching you and just how relaxed you are and the fact, like Bradford would say, that you do try things.
Yeah, I just feel the same way about you guys. I feel, at the risk of this being like, you know, a two-way street of affection and support.
Dude, I'm here. Let's make it a three-way.
Please, no, Roger. Just me and you, buddy.
It's
never the third wheel.
Oh man.
I think it's funny that you think I'm relaxed because I'm never relaxed. But I think we're supposed to be tuned into that moment in that imaginary person's life for that.
And I don't even know if when fans watch or anything, they see these things, but as actors, we probably have a little more insight to people's processes and how they get to the place they need to get. But you just you have a certain freedom about you that makes you really interesting to watch.
Thanks, Steve.
You know, so I don't know if that's on purpose. I don't know if that's life experience, because obviously there was a switch for you where you weren't so putting it out there as a theater guy to becoming way more subtle and underplayed than that.
Well, right. And also connected to more of yourself in your work, I would say. Because one thing I've noticed is you've become very comfortable in a style of character. Maybe it's because you played Todd for so long, who was not totally dissimilar to Franco in terms of their moral ambiguity, right? But right. So you can live in that space where these guys are unpredictable and making questionable choices on the fly or whatever. But that's not – there is something that – there's an inherent kind of wiliness to your character, I would say, a little bit. Roger's character that comes through in your characters, right? I don't know.
So – but where was the switch, Roger, from if you were a little – more theatrical to...
Well, don't get me wrong. I still fight against that. Like, I still have these habits that I'm still trying to chip away at, where it can become, you know, where I'm leaning on a, like a technique that doesn't work here. But sometimes, and it's weird, like, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but there's a tipping point for the material that we're asked to play all the time, where, like, if you have to kind of push...
Sometimes, yeah, for sure.
And if you don't kind of push, it the material just kind of falls really flat.
Right.
And so it is our responsibility to kind of find a life in these words, especially because sometimes, like, the words are...
Melodramatic?
Well, that's... Yes.
And I don't say that with a negative...
Oh, for sure. I don't think you're bashing on it at all. It's deliberately, like, this is the world
heightened.
Where... Yeah, where people are abducted by aliens and have, you know.
Sure.
Oh, did I just give away a future story?
Spinelli's an alien.
Well, I was going to say, they've never told my family story, and you just outed it. You bastard.
But, you know, it is different than doing film, because here, almost like, you have to make something of nothing sometimes that's on the page, right? You have to figure out how to make, hey, how do we make this two pages interesting?
Right, and also, if you're doing a film, they're going to tell you that that Jason and Drew were switched at birth. They're going to say it once.
Right.
And here we're going to say it 15 times between Monday and Friday.
Sure.
In Act 1, Act 2, Act 4, and, you know, it's going to... So you kind of have to figure out a way to serve that to an audience that's interesting... Where they're not going to say, like, oh, yeah, we already know that. Like, you have to kind of turn up the volume as you go along, or whatever it was. And it's not going to – you cannot give the same plot point in a script six times the same way.
Right.
Correct. Yeah.
So we have a responsibility to kind of put some spin on the ball somehow.
Yeah.
And I think everybody has their kind of tools to getting through those. Some people are kind of, you know – Yeah, I've just never played a guy that's like the throw it away guy. Like, I'm jealous of the understated.
Yeah,
no, dude, you're the scene stealer. I love it. It's amazing.
So because you also did some theater that paid you better than probably that first theater job. So theater's been in your life back and forth, because you did some soaps, then you did some
great theater. And when I say great, I mean high profile theater. You did Broadway, a couple times?
No, just the one time. I did a play called The Lion in Winter at the Roundabout in 2001, I think.
Yeah, I remember being in college at that point and like hearing about that, and I wish I had seen it.
Yeah, it was okay.
Were you off?
Your experience of it was okay? Or
it was a hard... It was difficult for a number of reasons. I think some of the personalities were, you know, just at odds with one another for whatever reason. And Lawrence Fishburne is like the greatest actor living in America ever. Like he just like the guy, I'd watch him do anything.
Sure.
And Stockard Channing has a skill set that's like beyond. I think I have tremendous respect. But they both bring stylistically. They bring different performance styles to put them in the same play was problematic. And I don't think that the director could really spend a whole lot of time kind of getting them to play in the same sandbox. So I got notes every night. I got notes on closing night. And my head was a bag of cats. I did not know how to do. I have a lot of problems, but one of them is that I do really try to please the people that I work for, and it's not always in my best interest. And I tried so hard to please this director, and it just, like, at no point was I able to say, like, you know what? I'm going on stage, not you. Leave me alone. Yeah. I did not have the skill set at, you know, 35 or whatever that was.
So you were...
To say, like, I think we're done with the notes. Like, there's one matinee left. And,
right.
Give me a shot at it. So every single time
what
I
was he doing coming
was
to the, or what
there.
Was he or she doing coming to the show every night once you opened?
I don't know, and I just got some of the, and some
unusual.
Of the notes were contradictory. Like do this,
were they coming through the stage manager? Was the
sometimes,
director?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sometimes. But there was a real goal in mind for me, and that I was supposed to be able to find something in this character that to this day I have no idea what went wrong. But there was never a moment when I was on that stage when I was comfortable playing that part. And it would manifest in weird situations where, like, I would just get really super nervous and then say a line from another scene.
In the life of the play?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, man.
For sure. The character's name was Philip, and at one point Lawrence Fishburne called me Interrupting Philip. And every time he saw me in the green room for, like, a couple weeks after that, he was like, moo. And that deep resonant. And, it's... So embarrassing. Yeah, we were every character in the play is on the stage at the same time, and I just said a line from like another act, like really loud. Like I had this moment where I totally spaced out and I didn't know where we were, and then I panicked. It was like the red light on the camera and the soap opera went on. I was like, it's my line, and I said something from another play altogether. I have no idea what I said.
Wow,
I was never comfortable on that stage.
So what year was that?
2000.
So that was post first Todd Manning run, right?
Yeah, that was when I quit playing Todd and was never going to go back, like either the second or third time.
Right. When was the first time you got? Do you remember? Around the time you got Todd Manning?
93, maybe.
Oh, 93. So you did almost a 10-year run.
My son was 9 months old, so yeah, it was 93.
Sweet. Wow, that's good. And then you went.
No,
to
I'd left a couple times. I left every 3 years.
Okay.
And then would come out here and chase pilots and not get them, or even worse, get one.
Even worse.
Even worse, get one and then not get picked up.
And then return the car that I leased from BMW of Beverly Hills. And
wow, you made really great purchase choices.
A piano and a BMW.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not good with the money. That hasn't changed.
You haven't learned anything, huh?
No.
not at all. That's all right. We like it. So what, you're here. It's great.
When you started playing Todd, he was speaking of a character that made tough choices. I mean, Franco killed people, but
it was a different actor at the time.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But some of the things that Todd did were
horrible.
Yeah.
Todd was you though. Nobody else played Todd before you.
You originated him.
Correct.
Right. Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. He was not supposed to be a long-term character, correct?
That's what I've been told. I think
when
that,
you were hired,
but
you
I don't think
contract?
That was a, no.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
No, it was frat boy number two.
Right.
And
frat boy number two that did something terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a gang rape. We did a gang rape story.
Crazy.
In a fraternity in college. A young Marty Saybrook, who was the ingenue on the show, fantastic actor, terrific actor. And it was me and a guy named Josh and a guy named Sean. And they threw us in this weird story. Linda Gottlieb producing. Gene Passanante was on staff writing scripts. Mm-hmm. Michael Malone was the head writer. And he, at the time, I think there was a much more fluid sense of I mean, I don't know. I wasn't a writer, but I do think, like, I mean, you were doing this then. Well, not you, but you were doing this then, and don't you think that you kind of, like, they would just kind of shift a story towards whatever, whenever. There was less of a kind of...
Sure. It wasn't so structured.
Yeah. Right.
We're out, so far out. If they saw something happening, they could just kind of change gears and go.
Yeah, and the audience responded to this story. It was horrible. It was a horrible, horrible story. And you dropped that pebble in the pond, and it affected the entire community. It was, so the district attorney and the...
Yeah.
That's cool, though. I mean, it's kind
of... In terms of storytelling, it's
kind of what Tony Geary did, right?
Yeah.
With Luke and Laura. I mean, I don't want to say it was the same thing, but it was kind of a spin of that.
No, and I think that they were really... I think that it was really... It must have been difficult to try and figure out how to keep that guy around.
Yeah.
When he'd done something so horrible and reprehensible and unforgivable. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, seeing someone that has done that actively trying to come back from that is it. I don't know a whole lot about One Life, but was Todd.
Yeah, I don't either.
Was he seeking, like, I want to redeem myself, I want to be a better guy, or was he always, like, doing it for other people's sake? Do you know what I mean?
I think that the writers wrote a character that was genuinely interested in
bettering himself?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Cool.
So that's...
Because selfishly it would feel better. And it was also, there was a little bit of a push and a pull. This is an unpopular position, I'm sure, but if I could have kept the character a horrible human being, I would have preferred that. Mm. And I did not understand why they needed him to be a not...
More likable?
Yeah. I think that it was a time when the villains were... And not necessarily sexual violence, which is its own, like... particular anomaly, and the actual facts are, like, you know, the recidivism rate is something like 99.something%, right? So it's hard to sell a redemption story with that particular set of verbs, but, like, I do think that playing that you need a bad guy on the canvas, and I thought that I always thought that Todd should be the bad guy on the show.
Yeah, but I can imagine that. If that's where your head's at in terms of who that guy is, 3 years, every 3 years you might need a break.
I didn't realize that, you know, I hear people say all the time, well, I don't hear people say all the time, but I know, like, it's just a funny thing. Like, next time you hear someone say this, maybe it'll ring a bell somehow, but, like, I didn't know I was insane at the time. Do you know what I mean? Like, like the dude that I just rode a bike by, who's standing in the middle of 5 points of traffic trying to take all his clothes off right now, just a block or so from here, he's having a great day.
Right. Right, yeah.
Being around that angry energy, I'm not a method person. I don't feel like I need to be angry to pretend to be angry.
You could leave it at work.
I found it. If I'm truthful about it, the energy of punching walls and screaming at people and having nothing but sarcasm and dark, horrible self-loathing for decades, it chemically it'll seep into your...
I agree with you.
And it's... I don't think I'm an... That is also the definition of psychosis, like somebody who can't... Like, that's one step away from standing in traffic...
Right.
But I don't think I was a lunatic, but I do think, like, being around that, it's a different thing. And it's a little different, I think, than people who are working in, say, film or a play or
you go under for a month or two and then you come out.
And then it's kind of compounded by the fact that chemically people react to that energy on the subway. So it was a hard time for me, and I was young, and I didn't know how to deal with I think I'm pretty gentle, and people were like legitimately afraid when I'd walk into the train. They didn't know, there's a face recognition program in our brains that people were dealing with me as if I were this kind of.
Yeah, being on being a recognizable figure in New York City is a much different experience than being even a partially recognized, a somewhat recognizable person. Because, I mean, walking on the streets, sharing trains with people.
I love it, but
as a human being, yes. It's an incredible experience. Well, as someone that is recognizable, it's a different experience.
Well, I will also say this just like quickly. Please. It's a good focus group. I really wish that whoever is running the shows would just ride the train for a few minutes.
Yeah.
No, I swear, everybody's like, oh my God.
Not a Q rating, but an NRQW rating.
And they will say like, okay, so this.
thank you.
Well done.
Thank you.
So this thing, you know, they'll say, the such and such story is really not going anywhere and they should kill that. And there's like in the course of like four different train stations, somebody will break down the entire canvas of what is successfully landing with the audience and what isn't. It's
absolutely.
Great.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's actually funny. Focus groups on the subway.
Yeah.
No, but Roger, it's interesting because I had a time here where everything was so deep and heavy for so long that I want to say that I'm a pretty mentally stable person, but it seeped through into my life, and it was very difficult for a while because not only are you dealing with that kind of maybe pain or darkness or whatever you're doing every day, but then you have other things in life to deal with on top of that, you know. And there was a point where and it's interesting because we've talked a little bit about it before, and I know that you had some, I don't want to say issues, but it's like I feel like I had a walking nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
While I was on the show, I felt.
That's interesting. I'm sorry.
I felt like because I couldn't. Something snapped in my head driving home, and I was done.
Wow.
I wanted to literally throw myself out of the car, like something happened to me, mentally, you know, and it was the first time that I ever could not come to work, for like 3 days. I sat in a chair, like in the dark. For 3 days, and it was just I didn't know if I would get my mind back. Something happened, you know. And it's just interesting to hear you talk about that because, we should be able to shut things off and go home and be normal. But the truth is, you're really going through those things in some odd way mentally. If you're playing those stories for so long and so deep and so heavy.
You can rationalize the separation.
You
but
can.
That doesn't
but,
mean
but
that.
But your body and mind doesn't know the difference.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was weird, man. I had some problems with anxiety and just.
I'm sorry, dude. It's horrible.
You know, it was tough. But it's not odd for me to hear you say that when you say, oh, I hear people say this all the time.
I didn't know. But if I look back at certain, you know. Not like a couple of days. Like if I look back at some periods of time, it was just dark. It was just kind of like I feel like I went publicly. I went crazy publicly.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I just was acting weird shit out at that. And you know, when I came back to that show, Cassie kindly said, like, oh, my goodness, it's like somebody dropped you on your head. because being away from it for a while, I was able to kind of recover my sense of humor about what it was that we did.
Right.
You know, and also, like, it was just a different time in terms of the effort required to get through the day was greater. Because we really were working to – we were there till, you know, 12:31 at night.
Yeah.
Not uncommon to work. And it was seven shows a week. I worked 2 shows a week at General Hospital.
Yeah.
And playing Todd was
it was every day.
160 shows a year or something like that, instead of 100.
Yeah.
And it took its toll on my. I was just tired.
So
yeah,
when
it just made me tired.
When you would seek those.
I still loved what I did. But
oh,
like,
sure, dude.
But
of course.
When you would seek the other, like when you'd be like, okay, I'm time for a break. Was it? Did you see it as I need a break from this, or I'm
creatively, I want to do something else.
I wanted to do other things.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also, like, interestingly enough, I'm not surprised now looking back that it didn't work, because I think what I brought into the room, you know, I had shots. I would read for things that were great.
Yeah.
But I think I brought that energy into the room. I think that they could,
the
buyers could probably, you know, who would want to work with that guy? What's he so He's upset about?
Bit of a drag.
It's interesting. Subconsciously, it was almost like you needed a break.
Well, and I also had, know? I think I had reinforced the pathways of my brain thought that that's what the work was.
Sure.
Was to approach it with that kind of intensity and that kind of manic.
Yeah.
Kind of attachment.
It's interesting.
And I wouldn't hire that guy. I wouldn't have hired me.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
Just wasn't
man.
Quite right for the Big Bang Theory.
Oddly enough.
So tell me about your, how many kids?
That would be kind of funny if Todd Manning was sitting on the couch with Sheldon.
That's funny, dude. You have kids. Let's talk about your kids. How many kids do you have?
Two kids. I have a 27-year-old boy and a 17-year-old girl.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, they're good kids. They hold the door for it. I'm taking an acting class on Sunday, my first class in 30 years. The guy
who
asked,
is?
I am.
Roger Howarth is?
Yeah. And the guy, the teacher, said, I'm going to send you a Q&A. And it was like...
A questionnaire of sorts?
It was, but it was, you know... Okay, so the first question was, name five things that you like about yourself.
Oh, dude, the stuff about... Yeah, we've talked about this a little bit on the show. I'm curious to get into this with you. Go ahead.
No, no.
I want to hear the rest of the story. I'm so sorry.
No, please continue. I want to hear five things that you like about yourself, Brad.
Those questions are incredibly hard for me.
Well, I think they're hard for... Should be hard for everybody.
Well, I mean, it's not a question.
I actually had no problem.
Oh, you did? Okay.
but what I found was the next question was name five things that you don't like about yourself, and they were the same five things.
That's funny.
One of the questions was, you know, what are you most proud of? And I wrote down that I have helped to raise two children that will hold the door for somebody when no one is looking, and they just kind of are nice people. I like my kids. They're good kids.
That's great.
That's a
yeah,
nice,
they're really cool. I like
nice
talking to
explaining.
Them. I like what they have
that's
to say.
That's a victory as a parent.
Yeah, they're awesome. You they're know? Really cool people.
What does your son do?
My son is currently in school. He was a soccer player right out of high school.
Oh,
he left
right
high
on.
School at 17, and he went to Sweden
you
to
had a
try
bit
and make
of
it
soccer
as a soccer
foray,
player.
Right? You played some ball in your time.
I love soccer. I love everything about soccer. I am a terrible soccer player, but I just love it.
I mean, you traveled playing.
When I was little, I was part of I can't complain about my upbringing, like I said. Yeah. I went to soccer camp like kids did in the
That's okay. cool.
And that turned into an opportunity to go to different places on a team and play. It was fun.
So
it was really fun.
Whatever soccer genes you have, your son made them.
You know, it's funny. Like I kept saying, because I do feel I have zero resentment. My dad is like a sweet man. I have no resentment. And we started out this talk. You know, I was talking about what it was like to be the son of a director, drama teacher.
Yeah.
And I felt like I didn't choose to be an actor. Like I could. Was I resentful about that? Not really.
Yeah.
But I did say to my son like 20 million times, like, yeah, I love soccer, but you should make your own choice.
Right.
And sure. Finally, at like, you know, I mean, he was young when he said it. He was like, look, Dad, I love this game. It's got nothing to do with you. Over yourself.
That's
got
to be nice to hear, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he wakes up in the morning and he thinks about soccer, and then he plays soccer, and then he coaches soccer, and then he watches soccer, then he goes to sleep and he dreams about soccer. This is his kid.
It's still number one in his life now.
He is pursuing a UEFA B license. He lives in, which would allow him to coach anywhere in the world.
Wow,
and
that's cool, dude.
His experience as somebody who's learning to coach have all been really positive and
fantastic.
He has a big interview this week with a big club in London. And,
wow,
sweet!
To do, I think, some kind of analytics.
On players.
I don't always understand what he's talking about.
Well, it sounds like math. So
that's great, though, man. That's great. And what is your daughter?
My daughter is a rising senior in high school in in Brooklyn, and she
better than, yeah. better than a declining senior. I suppose, right?
Yeah, she might. She would well, prefer to decline. That was my career. I'm sure. Yeah, right. She both loves school, and I think she'll. But she would like to. I think she's a kid that wants to go to college. So that's a big part of the conversations with her right now, and yeah. she's trying to figure out what that looks like.
Yeah,
is she into arts at all, or writing? She likes writing.
All of it.
Acting too.
She's a terrific actor.
Wow!
She's an amazing actor. I saw her do. She did a production of Wolves, which is this cool like what would happen if soccer and theater had a baby? It would be Wolves about and all the girls were great, and she was amazing. And
that's so cool.
Yeah, I was super happy to get to. I got to go back to New York to see that last month, and. This time last year, she did a scene from Our Town that I still remember. She was
anything just that takes place in New
amazing.
Hampshire is genius.
Not really.
Is that where that's set?
Our Town. New Hampshire.
Oh, Our Town.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant Wolves. Oh, no. That's in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't remember. Grover's Corners.
Not many people there.
Grover's Corners, New Hampshire.
This guy is going to be mayor of freaking New
the
Hampshire.
The stage manager over here.
Yeah. That has got me thinking about when. You were recruited to come when One Life to Live ended. You were on. Were you on As the World Turns when One Life to Live? No, back.
No, I was on One Life to Live.
Right.
And
Michael told us a bit about that experience.
Michael was actively recruited. I texted Frank Valentini Merry Christmas after a couple of cocktails. I had a couple of cocktails. Right. I texted him saying Merry Christmas. Hope things are going well.
Right.
And I don't – either he said, you want to come work for a day or something – or I said, can I come work for a day? Right. But somewhere while I was walking my dog after some eggnog, I agreed to come. And to come to General Hospital.
From New York.
Was with Florencia and Cassie.
But that was a temporary thing in your mind.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, because, I mean, your family is on the East Coast.
Correct.
So
I don't remember the situation that brought everybody to town. I do remember I got to work with Maurice. I was incredibly nervous.
There was a car, there was a car accident or something.
I don't remember, dude. I remember that G handed me a gun or somebody handed me a gun. They handed him a gun. And I was like, this is weird. Because cool. That was sunny.
Yeah, well, sure.
It was sunny. Awesome. And it was in the courtroom.
You're Todd, damn it.
It was a weird situation when we walked in and there were...
And you were playing Todd at the time? Well,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I still get really nervous when there's more than two or three people in the scene. Like when you're... If it's a funeral or a wedding and all of your castmates are there, it's a different energy.
Well, you have an audience. It's a bit of... I mean, you always have an audience with the crew, but when it's a crowd of actors, it's a different audience.
Yeah, they're required to be awake, or at least appear awake.
Yeah. At what point were you like, okay, yeah, I'll be here? Like that must have been a big decision.
Yeah, I don't remember it being a big decision.
Right. Just because I know your life is in two different places.
Yeah, no, I don't. The plan was the plan was to come to California eventually, and then. We did, and then my daughter was in a school for 1 year, one school year.
Yeah,
and it was really hard for her.
That was
hard.
She came here and did
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We were all here, and
that's tough, man. It's a tough age
didn't,
to do
I,
that.
Yeah,
too.
And I just didn't feel like it was appropriate to ask a teenager to go to a whole new school and. Just so I could play Franco on General Hospital. So I said, it's still a work in progress.
Of course, yeah. I mean, with kids it is, right? There's so many decisions.
Looking back on it, I think she might have benefited from just kind of sticking it out of that school, and it would have been a different situation. And there were a couple other things that contributed to
Sure, yeah. Yeah,
it's tough, man. I mean, I did it for... When I was on YNR for almost 5 years, traveled back and forth and try to make it work, and you know, there's dynamics, man.
Yeah,
it's life, and I think I probably would still do what you're doing, Roger, if because we had homeschooled my daughter
right
until last year. So if she was in a place where she was super comfortable and had her people and,
yeah,
you know, I probably would still be doing what you're doing for my kids, you know?
Yeah, her friendships are really, really important to her.
Yeah. Well, it's important to have good friends.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd rather have my kid be somewhere they want to be and have great friends as opposed to be kind of the fish out of water and dealing with some stuff because self-esteem-wise, especially for a girl, not great. I'd rather her feel amazing, right?
Yeah, I would like for my kids to feel amazing.
You know, so just in that respect, I think it's, you know, it's great what you're doing. I know it's tough sometimes, but it's great.
Yeah, we're actually not here as much as I think that we're here.
People think we are. as much as. Yeah, we have a lot of time off, which is great. So you get to go home for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's awesome.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. Well, man, we're glad you're here.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it time already?
Well, hold on. Let me just end with this one thing. What? Because I know you had a muscle car, which I loved, and it was a Camaro.
I did. I had a 67 Camaro. I had that Camaro for 18 years.
Tell me the story again.
The one where it was stolen?
Yeah.
That's not a good story.
No, but it's exciting.
It's exciting that somebody took my car?
Did you chase them down?
Did
you hunt them down?
It's a great story.
Did you hunt them down?
No, I just went to New York City, and my buddy took the car for the time that I was going to be in New York, and he took his girls to school with it because they loved it because it was shiny and red. And
what kind
really
of car
loud.
Was it?
It was like a 67
Sweet
Camaro.
Wow.
Like a Porsche orange red paint job. And
ooh, yeah.
And you had it for how long?
18 years. Yeah, and then he parked it in front of his house, and then somebody took it. It's kind of an anticlimactic. Do you remember the story being better than that?
I thought it was here. I thought it got stolen here.
It was here. It was parked on.
Oh, it was in California.
Yeah, Mitchell Terreno in Silver Lake.
Oh man, I'm sorry, dude.
Oh man.
Yeah, it was rough. And he called me.
That's why you're on a bike.
He called me.
Those get stolen pretty quickly.
I said, "What happened?
LA
the car
too.
The car won't start." And he was like, "Kinda." And there's footage of it from his
video doorbell or something.
Yeah, he's got a video, which I think is just the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
What?
This is a house that he owns as a my friend owns this house as it's a rental property, it's Airbnb, and sitting and hanging out, and he'll like pick up his phone, and you can see like somebody delivering pizza and weed or whatever at his house.
Sure.
On a doorstep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If
somebody,
there's one, chances
somebody
are there's
car.
The other two. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody took it. Yeah,
somebody
so
took
that,
the car.
And he does not. I know bikes get stolen, but if you've seen his bike, no one's stealing.
But
this
here's
bike.
The thing.
No, okay, but the bike is not. I actually don't own that bicycle. It's
what?
It's a friend of mine's bicycle. So, and the guy who owns that bike is another New York City person, and it's a sleeper bike. It is deliberately ratty.
I know. That's
it
what I'm
doesn't
saying.
Look like a nice bike, but it's got campy parts. And
it's good.
Like,
wow.
Yeah, it's. Yeah.
At first glance, you're like, I'm not taking
just
that.
Just keep
thing.
Walking by that one.
So when I don't know much about car thievery, but when you steal a car that is orange and that year and very specific, do you just paint it and resell it, or because do you take that down for parts?
Yes.
They take that
the
down.
Detective,
for parts.
The detective, the detective in
it's
Glendale said that it was probably already in pieces because they're at that time in November of 2018 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
There a bunch of cars kind of like that had disappeared from LA County.
Oh, mm. So people.
And, but they did say some weird stuff when I was talking to him. He goes, "Well, we'll put it.
we'll put some weird stuff."
Well, first of all, like that car. It was a character. Like it was its own kind of. It took on its own life. I once did get pulled over on Delancey, getting onto the Williamsburg Bridge in another car that I owned, and I mistakenly handed the police officer my license and my registration. But the registration, because I'm an idiot, was for the Camaro.
Yeah.
And the cop looked at my license and looked at the car, and then looked at back at the registration, and then looked at me and said, "You have a '67 Camaro?" I said, "Yeah, I do." He goes, "All right, drive safe." Handed it back to me. It was like my literal get out of jail.
That was
card.
Amazing.
Yeah,
millions of little stories like that. People would always stop and talk. And my brother had one, but he crashed it. And then there was always a drunk brother in almost all of the stories about the Camaros that people would tell me at stoplights. But yeah, and then when I told the detective in Glendale that it was gone, he said, "Yeah, first of all, I'm really sorry, and second of all, it's probably in pieces."
People.
I know, man.
You know.
Hey, it happens.
I had a good run with it. It was fun.
One more question.
I'm curious. So you went, you played Todd on her show, and now you're playing Franco. I'm sure there's some things that you miss about not playing Todd anymore. I'm sure there's things maybe you like about playing Franco. Is the transition from one character to another? How did you approach that? What do you appreciate about the character you're playing, and what do you miss about the character? So it's a multi-layered
question. It's a lot of questions.
Sorry.
Gosh, no, dang,
cool.
Dude.
I'm going to try and answer
Roger
them.
Was halfway out the door.
I know. Oops.
I love the character, Franco. I think he's great. I think it's a really fun part. I feel really fortunate.
Thank God for that tumor.
Thank God for the tumor. I do think that it might be time to revisit a Jason Franco conflict-based story.
You're not related anymore. You were brothers, right? But Susan Moore?
So there was a time where we were supposedly...
Brothers. Twins.
Twins.
I remember that.
Yes, and that didn't really work.
I don't know what happened.
I don't know either, dude.
No, I feel like. I shouldn't say what I feel like, but I feel like. I think it was a vote of no confidence in my own ability to pull that off. I really felt like I was like, oh, we're gonna do this cool thing, and it's gonna be, Drew and Franco and Jason are somehow interrelated, and then Franco kind of got dropped from that story. I feel like there was a network meeting on that, and they were like, yeah, it's a different cue. Like, let's not.
I don't think so. I think it's too muddled with three.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm trying to remember your question.
That transition from
The transition didn't go well by any stretch of.
How did you try to approach it, though? I guess is more what like
I tried to do what I thought was asked of me,
right?
Which was to not appear like Todd, because I think everybody was terrified of some kind of
legal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seemed kind of a fear-based decision. I can say that.
Yeah.
I think.
So
I dyed my hair some like ridiculous color.
Oh, it was like a little highlighter?
I went what was that guy? Home Alone?
Macaulay Culkin.
I did a Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah.
I saw that hair.
Yeah.
It's like Billy Idol.
It was rough. and of course, the first day was, I remember you in the first day, and it was, by the way, Roger, here's 23 other cast members that you barely know. Go overact in front of them.
Don't worry, Franco, I was right there with you, buddy.
Franco literally had to, like, they had to reintroduce him to the canvas by saying, like, oh, and I had this relationship with you, and oh, this is you, and I'm back. And, like, I had no idea what I was doing, and I had no idea. I did make a deliberate choice to not.
Was that, like, a Halloween episode or something?
It was something.
Like,
Haunted
in the Haunted Star.
Yeah.
Yeah, you came back, yeah.
It was terrifying.
That was hard. I remember thinking, that's hard.
It was fun in the end, but sure. Yeah, it was a little bit of a dare. But I also think Ron was trying to literally assert his voice in.
Sure.
And that was the task.
Right.
So
Ellie and I may have been dressed up as DNA, so I may have been in a full body suit.
Perhaps.
So I might have been uncomfortable on that
perhaps.
Day too.
I doubt it.
That was a sweet. That
I'm
was
sure you were very comfortable.
That was
you
a
weirdo
sweet relationship. It was, I think the show misses that. That was good stuff.
Well, yeah. So you approached it with certainly a brave approach.
Well, anything that we do, you're either going to go through it, or if you go in, you got to just do what you're told.
Yeah.
So, there's things that I miss about playing the character of Todd, but they're mostly just about that time in what we did where you didn't, as an actor, feel so isolated as a character. Like the characters were kind of interacting. You know, Todd had relationships with Dorian and Vicky and Star and Taya and Blair, and there were a lot of opportunities to have that character speak differently to different people, because mm-hmm. I always think that people talk to people differently, social characters. So.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Like
absolutely.
So like if you put
it's about relationships, right?
Yeah. Right. Jason's gonna talk to Sam differently than Jason talks to Jake or Alice Quartermain or whoever, right?
Yeah.
So, and I do think now we've kind of. Like the way we're doing it now, because of the sets maybe or whatever it is, we do seem kind of isolated. Like there are stories on the show I have no idea what they are.
Yeah.
Right.
No.
So but you like Franco, you like.
It's a great character.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Super fun.
Yeah, I mean I've always admired your ability to enjoy yourself on set.
I just wish there was a way that we could work together
and you not have to like physically assault him?
Yeah, just the fact that, you know, because there's such I thought,
you know, with Franco being with Elizabeth and Elizabeth having history with Jason, that when Jason became, when Steve Burton came back, I thought, well, you don't need to write tension between Franco and Jason. Like, it's inherent. Like,
right.
That's already... Yeah. Like it doesn't have to be
it's
about.
Been established.
Well, it's just weird. It's just weird.
As soon as
how...
that guy walks in the room, Frank has got to be like, "Whoa, you know, right. Who's the?"
Yeah, it's just. I mean,
and Jason's such an alpha and such a like it would have to. It would have to. Give
but,
right.
Yeah, but it's weird. I mean,
like
obviously,
a missed opportunity
it's,
to me.
Yeah, it seems like it's written that, like, you're the only person that I can't let live. Right? That's what it feels like to
me.
Are
you telling me this? Is this future story?
No, no. No, no, but because you let, you know, things happen to everybody on soaps, especially right. if you're, you know, like, look at like Shiloh, for example.
Right.
Right. It's like, you can't, how, what else can this guy do before he dies? I mean, that's, his character's done such horrible things that, I mean, death is really only next. But I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't either.
But for us, because of what Franco did, James Franco did to Sam, there's no grace for me at all to you, like right. zero. But I have to have grace for Shiloh.
Oh, you do.
I have to have. Well, I'm just saying because I'm in scenes with the guy. I can't right. beat him up every scene.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? It's like yeah. all these other enemies or whatever sure. I have to we have to be able to have scenes with
yeah
so there has to be something at some point. It can't be so black and white with Jason and Franco. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Right
there has to be something somewhere that not necessarily common ground, but at least the fact that we can do something together
right
know, as actors.
Yeah, that's, I think
that's what I would love to do.
I think me too. That'd be neat.
We could do a pretty incredible
no without you and
production of The Lion King. We
Let's
have Mufasa, we have Scar.
Yeah.
If you can lift me up, I can try to be Simba.
Oh, I could lift you up Simba. If you
no,
stop drinking.
I'm more Rafiki. I'll be the crazy old baboon with the fruit
in the tree.
I'll be just smearing fruit on people's foreheads
in the tree.
Woo! Yeah. So,
Roger, you're the best, man. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Good times.
Great.
Be careful on that bike. Wear a helmet, bro.
Okay.
He does not.
I will. Of course.
He does have a bell, though.
I do have a bell.
Ding-a-ling.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you, guys.
Get ready to turn out for the Dance Room on Podcast One.
Join renowned veteran dancers and choreographers Heather Morris from Glee and Ava Flave as they share their onstage stories, chat it up with guests, and recap all your favorite TV dance shows.
Download new episodes of The Dance Room every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, the luxury package you got after a big promotion, or just the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car's worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in.
Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few questions. Navigation and moonroof? Watch as they bump up your value. High mileage? You already knew it was going to cost you, but now you know how much it dings your wallet so you can plan ahead. And once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.